Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and start because we have lunch right after this, so you'll be highly motivated to start and finish, right? So, my name is Patsy Moskal, and I've got the pleasure of moderating a very novel panel here. These experts will address three questions that are often asked in looking at the effectiveness of online learning. How can I harness the power of disruption? Will teaching online adversely affect my evaluations? And finally, is it scalable? The city, or the University Director of Academic Technology for the City University of New York, where he's supervised instructional technology since 2001, Dr. George Oddie chairs a committee of directors of academic or instructional technology from CUNY's 20 campuses. He's also the chief academic officer for CUNY School of Professional Studies, home of CUNY's first online degree programs, and he's a professor for over a quarter century. He's on the doctoral faculties. Sorry, George. He's on the doctoral faculties of CUNY's Graduate Center programs in English, Urban Education, and Technology and Pedagogy. Gardner Campbell is Vice Provost for Learning, Innovation, and Student Success at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's been involved in teaching and learning technologies for nearly two decades now. He is a Fry Leadership Fellow and has served on program committees, advisory boards, boards of directors with numerous teaching and learning organizations, including EDUCAUSE, ELI, and the New Media Consortium, among others. Gardner's also a professor and scholar of English, and you can find his musings and more information on his blog, Gardner Writes. Chuck Jubin is the director of the Research Initiative for Teaching Effectiveness at the University of Central Florida, where he has been a faculty member since 1970, which will make George feel better, right? Since 1996, he has directed the impact evaluation of UCF's Distributed Learning Distributed Learning Initiative, examining both student and faculty outcomes, as well as gauging the impact of technology on the academy. Chuck was named UCF's first ever Pegasus Professor, which is for exemplifying extraordinary research, teaching, and service to the university. He's now a professor emeritus, and in 2005, he was awarded the most outstanding achievement in online learning by an individual by the Sloan Consortium. And in 2012, UCF established the Chuck D. Jubin Award for Excellence in Online Teaching in Chuck's honor. The presenters here have experience in technology-enhanced education from a teaching, evaluation, and administrative view spanning more than half a century. They have numerous presentations, publications, and they serve in leadership capacities to motivate positive change in education. I would be remiss if I didn't recommend or at least talk about one other person, who is Dr. Phil Long. Phil was supposed to be joining us today, and he could not make it from the University of Queensland, so he would have been the fourth on the panel. So if Phil is watching, we miss you and are sorry that you're not here. But it's my pleasure to begin the panel with Dr. George Oddie.
Thank you. We miss you, Phil. I guess Australia is even harder to get to than get from to New Orleans than New York was yesterday. And because Phil was going to, and I know a lot of people are here for that, Phil was going to say something about the question, how do I MOOCify my course? I'm going to try to weave MOOCs a little bit into what otherwise would be a too fuzzy discussion of disruption. I guess it's always a little problematic, and I think I have to say at the outset, you know, why shouldn't you ask questions, even these questions? And the answer is that if you ask certain questions, it's probably because they're coming out of certain assumptions, and it's those assumptions that we're really after. I have a couple of ways of looking at the assumptions behind this. And I'm sure you'll see this from Gardner and Chuck as well, which is another way of saying there's probably something to offend everybody in this presentation. Okay, so one of the assumptions, I guess, is that you have a way of looking at disruption that's a little like this, that you have an idea that disruption is this incredible untapped potential, this wild power that you can jack into somehow, if only you could find out how to use, say, huge online courses. Problem is that unless you're Ben Franklin, and I love this, I always thought he was a superhero, I never saw him look like one, and you know exactly how to sling that key, you could get your ass fried. Another problem would be that, you know, even if you are Ben Franklin, you may not have the resources, especially the technology, to tap that potential at the present time. So that's one way of saying it's not the right question to ask. Here's another way of looking at it. I'm a big fan of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I hope you all recognize this. And this is the way it looks to you if what you're really about in trying to harness the power of disruption is less about disruption than all the things you need disruption to fix. Enrollment problems, faculty productivity problems, student debt issues, brand extension issues, cost issues generally. Even if you are the Grinch, or more likely Max, his dog, Max is the little guy in the snow, which is where I was yesterday. Sorry to keep referring to that, but it was a very traumatic experience getting out of New York. You may not have or find in disruption the power to get all the things that you want it to do done. You may be trying to pull off or just pull more than you can. Before I get any more abstract, I'd like to sort of talk a little bit about what disruption actually does, how it's supposed to work. And as you can see from the bottom, I think some of this is a bit of a fairy tale. To Christensen fans and others who are great believers in disruption. But this is, by definition, the way disruption is supposed to work. And I won't go over what's in the slide. I hate reading slides. But the real reason that how do I harness the power of disruption is the wrong question to ask is that you're the wrong person to ask it if you're working in higher ed. You're really not the disruptive force which necessarily comes from outside, so you're much more like Barnes and Noble or Tower Records about to get clobbered by iTunes or Amazon. Disruption comes from the outside. It doesn't come from within. And so your issue, which is, according to the metaphor I just used, the analogy, building a better book or record store isn't going to work because the disruption, eliminating the book or record store entirely, is really coming at you from beyond your purview and your context. Essentially then, if you believe this model, this possible fairy tale, you can't be the solution because you're part of the problem. There's also the question of how disruption actually has worked. The really clear thing so far is that disruption actually does come from the outside and is treated as an intruder. And so most of the news post-year of the MOOC, which was way back in 2012, is about resistance to disruption. The AAUP's Campaign for the Future of Higher Ed and all these organizations sort of mobilizing against this kind of disruptive change. But, and I have to say this, and I'm not the first one, I heard Tony Picciona talk about it in a session just previous to this. There's also a sense in which a lot of the talk about MOOCs post-hype has been much ado about nothing, that MOOCs are not so massive. The big success story coming out of San Jose State was, you'll remember, about 88 students who also met with a professor, as well as using the online content. They were in it because they were in the registration system, and it was something like a digital library that they were using while getting through that particular course. So not so massive, not so open, not so fully online, not so much really a course either. And there has been, in fact, a general sense that even in the big ones, you don't have students really participating, or even people resembling students. You have a lot of professors checking out the new thing, grad students, professionals in the field of, say, electrical engineering, trying to prove their chops, so that all of this ultimately doesn't seem to be making much of a dent one way or another. It's also, to some extent, and I realize I'm sort of giving the cartoon version of this, something that too much confounds transmission of information with education, which is a little more complicated, sort of the broadcast function as opposed to the social experience and development of knowledge. I want to step back a little from a lot of this and say that, you know, I don't have to talk about the MOOCs with 100,000 students and tiny percentage or retention rates. There are attempts to use disruptive moves and technology to do something within the current educational space. And I wouldn't even be allowed to talk about this, I guess, because it wouldn't sound that disruptive, except that Clayton Christensen has, in fact, published his theory of hybrids, which is really about the use of specifically of blended learning in the K-12 space. And he lays out the functions of this hybrid of disruption or disruptive innovation and the status quo, the current situation, and its four characteristics. And I guess the real question here is this really disruptive? If, going back to the first slide, this is about harnessing something, it's a little less like wrestling with naked electricity in the form of lightning and much more like sort of generating static electricity by, rubbing a balloon on your sweater. It's not that exciting, but it's safe. There's also the possibility that doing this sort of thing, because we have seen it and we do know what it looks like, not least of all in the higher ed space, not the K-12 space, is really a fallback position for disruptors that have sort of overreached. And you may have followed the discussion of the summit on MOOCs or in Orlando last year, the presentations of EdX, Argwal, and Kohler, Coursera, talking a lot about blended learning and lifelong learning and things that this is seeming to work for to some extent, and stepping back from claims that this is going to really revolutionize or reconfigure the higher ed space. And of course, that was semi-simultaneous with Sebastian Turun in a now notorious interview for Fast Company saying that students really weren't ready for it, it really wasn't working, and he was going to go into corporate e-learning. So this might be something a little less than what we expected as revolutionary. The claim, for instance, that the use of MOOCs for blended learning would create the best of both worlds for a lot of people in the audience, and I was one of them. Reminded them of something that they'd heard said about blended learning for about a decade and a half. So again, this is disruptive. So when I hear about you know, MOOCs in particular, falling back on things like playing the part of a not-so-big flip classroom space or the online part of it, a kind of higher ed Reddit for adult learning, a new form of corporate training. It reminds me a little bit of how revolutionary Segways, remember Segways? You still see them because they're the preferred mounts of mall cops and Steve Wozniak when he wants to play polo. You know, and that you probably remember hearing this is going to revolutionize what we know about transportation. Not so much. No, this is our ROI, our return on investment for this is the revolution. The real problem, and that's why everything I've said so far really smacks of oversimplification, and I confess that it does, is that the real problem with MOOCs or Segways or whatever is not that they're new and different. They are, to a considerable extent. They've taught us a lot about scale or gyroscopes in the case of Segways. But it's the claim that they're going to be revolutionary, that they're going to have that kind of world-shattering, life-altering impact. And the reason that they don't is not that they're not good or interesting or whatever or new, but that they are confronting complex systems, that the real point to be made about education, no less than political life, is that we are looking at a complex system. We are looking at a system that has all kinds of points of resistance, breakdown, acculturated behavior, institutionalized inertia, especially in the higher ed space. And counting on managing all that is a little like trying to set up a Super Bowl where both teams play well, the halftime show clicks, and the weather behaves. And you can probably get 2 out of 3 at best, certainly not last Sunday. So that is why my last image for you, if you're still especially interested in harnessing the power of disruption, is of Xerxes at the Hellespont. Now, if you remember your history, and remember the story is largely supposedly apocryphal, but retold again and again, Xerxes was planning to cross from Asia into Europe. He built a pontoon bridge. Actually, his many minions did that for him. And there was really bad weather, the kind of storm that we see on a weekly basis here lately. And you know, like the one that's coming in tonight, I guess. And it destroyed the pontoon bridge. And this infuriated Xerxes. And so he ordered the sea lashed. And it worked. Again, this is an apocryphal story. The sea properly chastised, calmed down, and he was able to get his troops across and off to Thermopylae. So if you're really interested in harnessing the power of disruption, the best I can say is more power to you. And I mean that quite literally. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Chuck Jubin. Good morning to our virtual audience as well. The question I never want asked of me again is, Chuck, the end of course evaluation doesn't work, what are you going to do about it? I never want to hear that question again, ever, okay? Because in many respects, my faculty is asking me to reconcile the Mezicles and Guermantes ways. How can I reconcile these two things? Here's a Dark Tower reference, okay? A long, long journey from my institution into this. How do we assess teaching effectiveness? What does it mean to be an effective teacher from the perspective of the students? We started with a form that was unveiled on our campus for 20 years. And faculty said to me, it's inappropriate. I'm teaching online and it asks me, how many times did you meet class? Did you meet class regularly? Were you available after class for office hours? It has no contextual meaning for the online course. So, what our faculty decided to do is repurpose it. Pay attention to the mode. And let me say this right now. I do not believe that mode is a treatment effect. I do not believe that the mode of a course is the primary driver of teaching effectiveness. So, what our Faculty Senate did is customize the end-of-course evaluation for the mode of the course. Design specific questions having to do with face-to-face courses with the mode. They had specific questions dealing with blended courses and specific questions dealing with the characteristics of an online course, believing that somehow in a complex system, they would moderate the outcome of the student evaluation. You know, my faculty members say to me, what I do with this is I read my overall evaluation and then I read the comments. You know what I mean? If you're teachers, haven't you had a comment that a student has written about you that has stayed with you your entire life? Sure you have. We all have. My favorite is, for me, Chuck Jubin is a very smart man. He may be even as smart as he thinks he is. Kim? That one stayed with me for a while. That one stayed with me for a while, and I have others that are just wonderful. All right. The question then is, does mode predict? Will the mode of a course carry some impact on the overall evaluation of your teaching prowess? Now, what we did is we developed through data mining a set of decision rules using the mode of the course, the level of the course, the college, the overall evaluation as the outcome measure, and the other 15 items on the evaluation protocol. What would predict? You want to see what predicted? Two questions. The questions being, were you able to effectively facilitate teaching? Could you communicate? That's the rule. If students assigned you an excellent on both of those items, the probability of her getting an overall rating of excellent is almost 100%, irrespective of anything else. Whoa. Now, do the items for mode predict that? Do you want to see the results? Good, because I'm going to show you the results. Okay. All right, here we are, blended. Supplemental questions, the R-squared, supplemental questions for blended learning. Oops. The rule. Oops. Shall we try it for online learning? Want to guess? Supplemental questions? What's going to come? The rule. Isn't that interesting? Face-to-face. Okay. Don't you love that parking was in there? Jim, don't you love the parking was in there? You know, when I gave this presentation to the Faculty Senate, I said to them, look, mode doesn't predict. Okay? It doesn't predict. And then they said, thank you, Chuck, for the excellent presentation. Now, here are the mode items we'd like you to include. Right. Face-to-face, similar result. Supplemental questions. Now, all modes. Same curve. Exactly the same curve. Every time. The rules work. On the form, on the protocol, on the end of course evaluation, if you look at the column on the left, there are the overall percentages of excellent ratings for blended, face-to-face, online, lecture capture, and blended lecture capture. Well, there appears to be a difference. A small one, but there appears to be the difference. Stay with me. Now I take everybody, I sort them into a pile of all those who conform to the rule. Then I put them back into the modalities, and you have the right column. The rule works. Now, if I ask students, did you have a desire, a strong desire to take this course? What you see is really a huge difference, right? Overall excellence was 26% if they had no desire to take the course, and 78% if they strongly agreed. But if I apply the rule, what happens? Isn't that interesting? I'm pretty interested in it. Now, this one I really like. What grade did you expect? What grade did you expect for your course? We're still trying to run down the 27% who gave the course an excellent and expected an F. You know? Well, we have talked to some of them. And they basically said, yeah, he did a good job. I just didn't do mine. I just didn't do mine in terms of doing it. So they assigned an excellent to it. But the rule works. The rule, in fact, works. Now, a new form and a new rule. After all of that, they believed me. Okay, they believed me. So we have eliminated all the items having to do with the mode of a course. And get this, my faculty senate, instead of lengthening the end of course evaluation, has shortened it. You know, never happens. Never happens. So we have a new form that has only 9 items. 9 items on it. Isn't that interesting in terms of what the evolution of this end of course evaluation would be? Now, I want to show you one more thing. Okay. A new rule. New form, new rule. This is the new rule. You achieved course objectives, you created a learning environment, and you can communicate. That's our rule. That's our rule. And I want to show you one more thing. One more thing, folks. Look at this. There are 9 items on the questionnaire. If I ignore overall evaluation and look at the correlations among the other 8 items, look at them. They're basically interchangeable units. So goes one, so goes the all. Isn't that interesting? And we've published some papers. A course is a course. There is very little change across that. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to partial out, take out the effect of the overall rating. What do you think? The relationships disappear. They virtually become independent items, the Anna Karenina phenomenon. So that overall rating is this sticky vitreous that pulls all these items together in some way or other. If you remove it, they make independent decisions about their courses. So where we are at the moment is we're still wrestling with this, and this for me will be Groundhog Day. It will never be over for me. Because whatever form is developed, it won't work, if you know what I mean metaphorically. So that's where we are with this is, however, in terms of student perception of their educational environment, the mode of the course has very little to do with the way they evaluate their learning experience. Gardner?
So I have something much less sophisticated to offer you. Something so aggressively simple-minded in its insistence on the dangers of avoiding complexity that the first part will be very easy. It will go by very, very quickly. And then there's a truly frightening part at the end. So you can brace yourselves. Don't get too comfortable because you're going to need a little stamina at the very end. So the question I said we shouldn't ask is it scalable? Possibly the most perverse question I could have chosen, since that's where everyone goes initially with online learning. Is it scalable? So why not do that? Why not ask that question? I've gotten really interested lately in this System 1, System 2 thing that Daniel Kahneman describes in a book that is called Thinking, Fast and Slow. And the System 1, System 2 dichotomy has now gotten to be so pervasive in my little mental toolkit that all I have to do to tell my wife how a meeting went at school is just come home and say, system one. And that's it. She understands immediately that it was not a great outcome. So what is system one and system two? System one is that part of your brain that goes, ah, got it, right, boom, there it is. So here's an example. A bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the bat cost? And system one will immediately say $1, and that's wrong, right? The bat has to do $1.05, and the ball has to be 5 cents, and now you've got $1 in between. But system one, which we need to escape predators on the savannah, to be able to parallel park, to be able to recognize our loved ones, comes in very, very handy. It's why you don't have to refigure out what a chair is. You just go, oh, boom, chair, good. But system one has its limitations, especially when we're dealing with complexity. It's not very good at thinking through anything that's just not quite as simple or direct as it seems. So we need system two. That's where we slow down and we go, we have to figure this out. And what's interesting, Kahneman points out, is that when you ask a complex question or a hard question about a complex matter, system one raises its hand too soon and you don't notice that it's happened. So I think in many ways what the theme has been for the Four Questions series, which is not the same as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, though we do have gray beards, has been, please, let's not substitute the easy question system one will ask and think something has happened, when we need to slow down and say to ourselves, what's the complex question here? What's the work for system two to do? And Kahneman points out it is quite frightening that it all happens so quickly, you won't notice that the question has been substituted. You will actually think you dealt with the hard and complex issue. You will feel very good about it. And a lot of the talk I hear within, well, higher ed or any organization, it's especially disappointing in higher ed since it's system two we seem to be working on, will immediately go into these substitute questions, so you never quite get to the complex matter. So is it scalable? How do we make that available to system two thinking? We have to ask, what is it? What is it that we're trying to scale? A very strange question. We're trying to scale enrollment. That's pretty easy, right? And I want to suggest that if you go to that initially, you're inevitably going to be thinking along scaling lines that have been shown pretty dramatically over the years, not to be terribly effective. For example, the one-to-many model, made famous in this case by the 1984 Macintosh commercial. There's an impressive kind of video conferencing, and it's a very big hall, but somebody's running down the chute with a hammer, and that's not going to work once that onslaught has happened. Or, if we get really adventurous, we can think about this kind of scaling, which has pretty good retention if the game is close. Otherwise, though, you look at that, and that's about the enrollment of a MOOC, right? University of Michigan Stadium, a successful MOOC, about 110,000. And what exactly is the it that's happening there? You can put those people together at that scale. Is it just the activity of that kind of aggregation? All right, so we want to be able to scale costs, scale it down, right? We want to be able to put more stuff out and have it cost less. System one says problem solved, but not so much. As Colonel Tom Parker used to say, how much does it cost if it's free? And you look here at this store that has a 50% off everything and the thrills are already cheap. The perception of the value of the experience, especially as it becomes more commoditized, inevitably takes us away from being able to do those things that we do best, explore complexity in complex ways, and leads to a kind of deadening uniformity, which eventually some provider will figure out a way to supply at very low cost on a very high enrollment scale, and will have essentially liberal learning turning into tchotchkes for the mind. Some would say we're already pretty advanced in that direction. All right, so we want to scale up quality then. At least we can land there, and System 2 thinks that it has something it can offer. But at scale? When what we're providing is commodified, uniform, standardized, we can get to billions, but what exactly is it? Uniform learning experiences, content delivery. Now with healthy salads, it's still McDonald's. Now, as I say these things, which I've been saying in one form or another for, I guess, over two decades now, because these are irresistible ways to go when you're talking about a network, I feel ashamed. Why am I saying this again? Nobody needs to say this. We all know this. It's crashingly obvious. It goes without saying. What we're really trying to scale is learning. But what is that? We have some ideas. More to the point, we have experiences within each of our lives of moments when the learning scaled to the point it took over who we thought we were, where we thought we were going. When the learning scales to that kind of impact, System 2 can be fully engaged. But apparently, this leap from System 1 thinking to System 2 thinking has not yet happened. Certainly hasn't happened in higher ed. Ted Nelson in 1974 writes, "Education ought to teach and reward initiative, curiosity, the habit of self-motivation, intellectual involvement. Educators and computer enthusiasts tend to agree on these goals, but what happens? Many of the inhumanities of the existing system, no less wrong for being unintentional, are being continued into computer-assisted teaching." 1974. Fast forward, 40 years almost, to the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission in the great Commonwealth of Virginia, and one of its recently released studies, the Review of Academic Spending and Workload at Virginia's Public Higher Education Institutions, December 9th, 2013. And when you get to the section on instructional technology, brace yourself. This is where Freddy Krueger and the nails come out. And I want to say, I'm glad that they did the work. I believe the people who are working with us in higher ed to try to figure out how governments can intelligently support and advance the state of the art in scaling learning are people of goodwill who are really, really trying hard. But it's a little depressing when you get to the slide that says, instructional technology has potential to reduce costs and improve learning, and here are the bullet points. Common belief that instructional technology can decrease costs and improve learning. No single definition of instructional technology. By now, anyone with a pulse and a System 2 has got their head between their legs so they won't faint. Studies in Virginia and elsewhere show mixed impact on costs and learning, but some conditions may best facilitate positive impact. This is the state of the art in at least one of the states in the union, and I don't think the others or the people in higher ed who are working with them are far beyond. So here's the recommendation. The General Assembly of the Commonwealth of Virginia may wish to consider appropriating funding for the State Council of Higher Education in Virginia to coordinate a committee, System 1 loves committees, of institutional representatives on instructional technology. Among other things, the committee should identify best practices for lowering instructional expenditures per student while maintaining student learning. Classic System 1. And you may notice also that the word improving has changed to the word maintaining. What was the question? Here are three questions we're trying to ask at Virginia Commonwealth University as we try to ramp up certain aspects of our involvement in online learning. Is the online course designed toward deeper learning, which has a specific meaning? The report from the Academic Research Council on Workplace and Education talks about learning that goes across domains, learning that's not simply about content delivery and content regurgitation, but something that's actually going to be able to work in an integrative way. Is the online course distinctive, or is it yet another McDonald's hamburger? Is the online course designed toward high engagement for student success, which does not mean an online environment with more buttons to click to raise your hand so the teacher will see you? Something more along these lines. This is Reddit, How many of you have an account on Reddit? Good. Good. It's worth trying out. It's like life and the world. There are parts of it you don't necessarily need to go to. Some parts of it are pretty interesting. Well, one of my online team, actually, no, I take it back. I found this during a distance ed meeting that was boring me, so I just went online and thought maybe Reddit will have something about distance ed. And it did. It came up with this Change My View forum. This is a very interesting place where people with strongly held opinions, who nevertheless are trying to remain open-minded about what they think, using particular rules in the forum, are practicing critical thinking without a credit hour or a grade in sight. 98,075 open minds when I did that screenshot, 176 online at that point. For people who have an opinion on something but accept that they may be wrong or want help changing their view. This kind of stuff is going on all over the place, and it is scalable. But if we think about scaling the learner's experience of being in a community with other learners, not in terms of can we decrease costs, can we pack more people into the 50,000-seat lecture hall, these examples of people driven by interest, curiosity, exploration, they do scale. But we are going to have to find something outside the room where we breathe our own exhaust to be able to get to a better system to answer to that question, is it scalable? Thanks.
Few minutes for questions. Anyone have questions for the panel? We also have an online audience, so if anyone from online has questions. No? It's lunchtime then, right? So, thank you for coming.